I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The Willpower Instinct combines the newest insights from psychology, neuroscience, and medicine to explain how willpower works. Useful information at a time of year when we tend to set goals. Turns out willpower is actually three different powers, as you're about to hear. And it's not an unlimited resource. You only have so much of it. So making choices about where you want to focus is important. Sleep, mindfulness, and food have an effect on your ability to use self-control. Guilt and self-criticism work against willpower, and so do your friends if they're in the temptation game. Dr. Kelly McGonigal runs one of Stanford University's most popular classes on the science of willpower. Her book is called The Willpower Instinct. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What's the good news about willpower?
Well, the good news is you have it. You know, when I talk about willpower to most people, the first response I get is, ugh, I don't have any of that. And I think most people think that willpower is a moral virtue that they lack, or maybe there's a willpower gene that somehow they did not inherit. But it seems like willpower is more a basic human instinct that everyone has. And more importantly, it's a trainable instinct. It's a strength that we can choose to develop.
You talk about it as if it's a muscle.
It is. Well, this is one of the most interesting findings from the science of willpower, that when we choose to use our self-control in strategic ways, we can actually get stronger. And every act of self-control that we intentionally develop, whether you are training for a marathon or learning a new language or even just improving your posture, it seems if you do it in a particular way, it actually makes it easier to then control all of your impulses, whether it's spending or what you eat or what you say and your emotions. And so this is actually, I think, one of the most optimistic findings from the science of willpower, that you can create willpower workouts that actually make it easier to control all sorts of things that we typically struggle with.
When you say easier, do you mean both easier in a simplistic sense and faster?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the ways that I like to think about willpower is to compare it to the physical heart. If you think about willpower and cardiovascular ability, and if you run on a treadmill, it doesn't just make it easier to run on a treadmill. It's changing your heart in a way that makes it easier to do difficult things. And then if you need to run down the street, you'll be able to do that. Dancing will be easier. Hiking will be easier. Anything that requires you to use your heart to give your body energy and do difficult things, that's going to be literally easier, and you'll have more endurance for it because you've done some training. And it seems like the brain works in a very similar way, that when you ask the brain to do something difficult, like control an impulse or control your attention, the brain actually gets better at doing that in general. So the next time that you have to really not say that thing that's on your mind but might get you into trouble, or the next time you need to stick to your budget or stick to your diet, the more practice you have, it's literally easier in the sense that when you're aware of those impulses you don't want to give into, you'll be able to recognize them faster. You'll be able to resist them more easily. And you won't be as exhausted by the process of it.
Why is it then that I'm going to get into how you do all this with you. But why is it that we all feel as if we set these goals and we fail at them, that willpower fails us so much if we have this capacity?
Well, I think, you know, we should probably start by defining willpower, because I think it goes a long way in helping us understand why we all feel like willpower failures. I define willpower as the ability to do what matters most to you, even when it's difficult or some part of you doesn't want to. I think a lot of people think of willpower as the ability to do difficult things without any struggle or resistance or temptation, as if those people with willpower, and they're never tempted. They always want to do exactly the right thing all of the time. But actually, willpower is really about what you do when you feel an inner conflict. And so I really think it's important for people to recognize that everyone struggles with things like temptation or procrastination, distraction, regulating your emotions. We all struggle with it, and willpower is the ability to remember what matters most to you and make that choice. So I think the reason so many of us feel like willpower failures is because we look at other people from the outside and their inner struggle is not always visible. We don't know who struggled with addiction. We don't know who's got anxiety brewing underneath the surface that they're keeping a lid on. We don't know that the person who's able to succeed at work is also exhausted and caring for someone at home. And yet when we look at our own lives, we're aware of these conflicts and the sense of having limited resources. So I think that recognizing that pretty much everyone is in the same boat is one of the first steps to being able to increase or train your willpower.
Stanford University psychologist Dr. Kelly McGonigal, author of the new book, The Willpower Instinct, a look at how self-control works and how to strengthen it. And we're looking at this at this time of year because with the turn of a new year, everybody starts to aim themselves really in a direction and, you know, hope for it to be the best year possible, help to be the best version of yourself. And so we start setting goals. And we thought this was so interesting that this has come out right now. So willpower, as you describe, is actually these three powers.
Yes.
So let's go through them. I'll say what they are. There's the I will power, there's the I won't power, and I want power. So let's take them one at a time. The I will power.
I will power is the ability to find the energy and the motivation to do things even when a big part of you doesn't want to do them. Classic example is maybe getting out of bed early, going to the gym, you know, staying at the gym even when you're feeling tired and you want to give up on the last rep. There's some part of you that says, no, okay, I'm tired, this is difficult, maybe it's uncomfortable, but I'm willing to do it. Another example of I willpower is overcoming self-doubt or anxiety. This has been a big one for me, actually. I willpower has been one of the aspects of willpower that I've had to do the most training on. And that's when, you know, you're having an emotion that says, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And yet you remember your values or your goals and say, well, actually, at the bigger level, I do want the consequences of being able to do this. And so I'm willing to do this thing that is uncomfortable or scary, or I'm not sure if I'll succeed. So that's I willpower. It's moving towards something, even when you experience resistance.
This is almost like not letting your unconscious emotions hold sway, but going to your thoughts to lead the way for you. That's what I hear you describing.
Conscious, unconscious, I mean, most of us experience, whenever we put our minds on something, most of us will experience some form of resistance. And I would say this is one of the top questions I get from people. Why is it whenever I commit to a goal, immediately there's some part of me that doesn't want to do it? Doesn't matter how rational the goal was or how motivated I thought I was, immediately there's some part of me that doesn't want to do it anymore.
Is that because it feels like, does it feel like deprivation?
Well, that is definitely part of it. Maybe we can talk a little bit later about why it's a bad idea to turn your goals into tests of your self-worth.
Yeah.
But part of it is just, you know, once we say we have to do something, then part of us will, like a two-year-old, say no. But I think part of it is whenever we move towards something we want, it does kind of dredge up a lot of old stories we might have or a lot of concerns and anxieties we have. And that's par for the course. And so I willpower is the ability to actually not have to get rid of all that junk that sometimes comes up when we have a goal. A lot of times people feel like they need to fix that first. Like, I'll be able to do this when I no longer have self-doubt. I'll be able to do this when I'm not so tired and exhausted. When I have more time, then I'll do it. And we have all these conditions that we think we require to be able to say yes to something that is difficult. But I willpower is basically the ability to say, you know what, my exhaustion can come along for the ride. My anxiety can be part of this. I don't have to fix that inner experience in order to take positive action.
That's so, so interesting right there. It's as if you're hearing the stories you're telling yourself and saying, well, that's interesting. You know, that's so interesting that I'm telling myself that story, and now I'm going to go do this thing. So that's I willpower. What about I won't power?
That's what most people think of as the classic form of willpower. It's the person who's trying to quit smoking, and do they have the I won't power to want to smoke but to resist that temptation? You know, it's the ability to not buy something that you really can't afford, the ability to not flirt with someone that really is not appropriate to be flirting with. Whatever it is that you sort of feel an impulse that you're drawn to, but you know you don't really want the consequences of giving into that. That's I won't power. And again, a big part of I won't power is the ability to tolerate inner experiences that we think we can't stand. You know, one of the reasons that we give in to something, whether it's a donut or a cigarette or buying something or saying something, is because we feel so much sort of inner discomfort when we think something will make us happy, but we don't quite have it yet. And a big part of I won't power is the ability to kind of breathe with that initial frenzy or panic. I need to smoke the cigarette. I need to buy this. And then I'll feel some relief, and I'll never do it again. Actually, what tends to give us the most I won't power is the ability to extend our willingness and ability to be with that discomfort.
Be with the discomfort. Mm-hmm. Listen to the stories, but don't identify with them. And the last one is what you call I want power. We're, of course, saying, as you do, that there are three different powers attached to this overarching concept of willpower. What's the I want part?
I want power is the thing I think actually most people underappreciate. And this is the ability to hold in your mind your big goals and your big values, the things that you identify with that really matter to you, the roles and relationships that matter most, who you want to be and what you want to offer the world. And basically, the brain has two ways to want something. There's this sort of short-term automatic want drive that really responds to immediate rewards, like the cigarette or the piece of cake or whatever that instant gratification is. And we're really used to practicing that way of wanting something. But the brain is a whole other system of motivation that is based on your deepest values, the kind of values that make you feel strong when you're aligned with them, or your goals for the long-term future. And the brain kind of goes back and forth between those two ways of wanting. And in order to have the strength to say, I won't to temptation or I will to things that are difficult, you actually need to be in that state of motivation where what's really driving your mindset is the long-term goals and your big dreams and vision for your life. And that turns out to be something you have to practice also, because there's so many things in our environment that are trying to capture our brain and put us in that immediate gratification mindset.
This is so interesting. Kelly, please stay exactly where you are. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to talk with you about how the brain is hardwired for reward and how we have what you're talking about and the reward system wanting to be fed, and how do we toggle back and forth between those two. So stay where you are. We'll be right back with more The Willpower Instinct. I'm Faith Middleton. Find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see delicious recipes for dinners and value wines, easy cocktails, and more. Click on programs at WNPR.org right now for the Faith Middleton Show. We are talking with Stanford University psychologist Dr. Kelly McGonigal, who's author of the new book, The Willpower Instinct. It's a look at how self-control works, how to strengthen it. It's like a muscle. And Dr. McGonigal's work and the work of many neuroscientists is now showing that this is a muscle that can be exercised and strengthened so that when you set goals, they work. We're at the time of year where everybody's thinking about this as you kind of have that sense of turning over a new leaf at the start of a new year. So here's the reward system in the brain, as you point out in the book. It's hungry all the time, and it's very hard to resist. There's a scientist who talked about having a freshly baked chocolate chip cookie on a plate in the house. He had to go upstairs. It was so hard to ignore it. Upstairs, he couldn't get out of his mind, so he left the house, and he ended up coming back after quite a long journey, and the first thing he did was walk to the plate and eat the chocolate chip cookie. So this is a scientist who was thinking about food and calories and food engineering. That's a mighty powerful reward system in the brain.
Yes. And actually, one of the things, the first things we should do is rename the reward system to the promise of reward system, because that really allows us to better understand the process you just described about why something can capture our attention so much that we become irrational and obsessed with consuming something that doesn't necessarily make us happy. And this is, I think, the key insight into the so-called reward system that's come about in the last decade or so, that these things that we feel addicted to and controlled by, and for many people, it's food, these are things that trigger a system in the brain that motivates you to approach and consume things. It's there to make sure you don't starve to death. And this system of the brain produces a feeling of a promise of reward. It's the feeling that you will only be happy when you consume whatever it is that triggered this brain response. And I think it's really important for people to understand that this promise of reward is also a form of stress and pain in the brain. You know, so that scientist who became obsessed with that cookie triggered a response in his brain that was like a stress response or like a physical pain response. And this is part of how the brain tries to trick you into consuming it by producing a discomfort that can only be relieved, so the brain tells you, by consuming the thing that started the process or the discomfort. And the thing that I talk about in the book that has helped so many people kind of become free from this obsession or addiction to food or other rewards is that the things that trigger this promise of reward almost never actually make us happy. And one of the things neuroscientists have learned is that wanting something and liking something are determined by completely different systems of the brain. And the things that we lose control over are the things that tell our brain something will make us happy, but then don't actually deliver on that promise of reward. So we get stuck in that cycle.
Why did nature give us that capacity where, it's sort of lying on one side?
It is. You know, it's really helpful if you think from an evolutionary point of view, when food resources would have been scarce. You might have to climb a tree or climb a mountain or go chase something in order to get adequate nutrition. And your brain needs to be able to motivate you to approach and to consume. It's the most important thing for your survival. And by the way, the other thing that really triggers the system is sex, mating opportunities. Initially, that's what the brain was adapted for, the reward system was adapted for. And those are the two most important things. And the brain wants to make sure that no matter what the barriers are, you are going to want it so bad that you are willing to do whatever it takes. And unfortunately now, for most of us, at least here in the U.S., food resources are not so scarce. We don't need that kind of willingness to do whatever it takes to consume any available food.
You say that willpower is not unlimited as a resource. That was surprising to me.
Yeah.
This idea that you only have so much of it and that you have to make choices about things.
There have been hundreds of studies showing that if you ask people to control one thing, control their attention, control their emotions, resist a brownie, that it then becomes harder to exert self-control again. The researcher who's most famous for looking at this is Roy Baumeister, and he's even found that willpower deteriorates over the course of the day. So he thinks of it as sort of being like a resource that you spend, that runs out the more you try to use it. So if you're counting calories all day, it's going to be really hard when you get home from work maybe to give your partner or your kids your full attention or to tackle the work that you had to bring home with you. That's the basic idea. And there's a lot of evidence for that model, that kind of forcing yourself to do things that are difficult, that kind of go against your instincts, that is really a limited resource. But I have to say, there's also a lot of evidence that when you are really aligned with your choices, it's not so willpower expensive. So to give the example of the kind of thing that often, people feel like they get drained by, something like resisting food temptation. If you're really deeply conflicted about it, you equally want the second helping of pizza and you equally want to lose weight or improve your health, that is going to be an enormous drain on your willpower. But people who are really fully committed to a goal, they don't show that same kind of resource drain. For example, people who are vegetarians for moral reasons, it doesn't tax their willpower to resist something that conflicts with that part of their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the ways that you can get around this kind of resource depletion is to spend time really carefully thinking about what it is you care about and how change will allow you to move closer to that.
Stanford University psychologist Dr. Kelly McGonigal, author of the new book, The Willpower Instinct. And this is a look at how self-control works and how to strengthen that muscle. The start of a new year is on the way, and lots of us make goals. And so we thought this was a great time to talk about all this. So what about this idea that too much self-control can be bad for you?
Yeah, most people, I'd say most people don't even think of this as a possibility, that too much self-control can really interfere with your health and happiness. And there are a few ways that this works. The way that I see it most often, and maybe this is because I'm at Stanford and in the Silicon Valley, is that people can experience what's sometimes referred to as a hyperopic regret. That means that they are so farsighted, they're always thinking about their future goals, their future self, controlling their appetites now, working hard, always putting off happiness, that they end up experiencing as much regret over their choices in their life as people who, you could say, wasted their life always giving in to immediate gratification and doing things that harm their health and happiness by never thinking about their future well-being. And this is it's not everybody, but there's a significant percentage of people whose version of self-control or willpower has to be to think about choosing momentary happiness over future happiness, to think about giving in sometimes instead of always saying no. And a lot of the people I work with at Stanford fall into that camp where they are maybe workaholics, they always delay gratification. They have the gift cards in the drawer that it's never the right time to spend it. They'll save it for when, there's really a special opportunity. And if they want to be happiest and healthiest, they really need to work on bringing their focus to what feels good in this moment. Mm. Do you know which camp you fall in more?
Yeah, I'm definitely in the other camp. I'm in the camp where if I say and commit to a particular, let's say, a health choice or a food choice, and I see those as being connected, my willpower seems to start to fade after about 3 days. So around 3 days, I'm weakening, and a little sentence goes through my head that somehow says it's really okay to have that thing, or I need to have that thing. And the commitment that I had for 3 days is weakened. So I in reading your book, I've been thinking a lot about this. I think, well, maybe around day two, I should reexamine my kind of moral positioning about this thing. What do you think?
Yes. Well, I think so. That's a pretty common experience to run out of commitment pretty early on after a resolve to change. And there are a few things that could be fueling that. One of the big ones, and this is huge for New Year's resolution, is to recognize that a lot of the times when we vow to make a change, we do it to get a kind of emotional payoff. And if I vow that I'm going to suddenly eat clean and it's going to, give me so much energy and improve my health, I feel really good the moment that I made that resolve to change. Or if I decide I'm going to get out of credit card debt, I feel so optimistic and hopeful. And there's actually a big payoff to deciding to change. And usually the emotional experience of actually changing is the opposite. We come up immediately with, well, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. And maybe we feel deprived. And maybe our life hasn't completely changed after the first day or two of trying to save a little money or eating a little bit better. And that gap between the initial emotional payoff and our actual emotional experience often drives us to give up on our goals. And that's something to really be aware of around New Year's time, noticing if the goal that you're setting is one you're choosing because it kind of feels good and optimistic to imagine the change versus a goal that you actually feel some want power behind, that there's going to be some drive to carry you through the fact that your whole life isn't going to change after the first few days of your commitment.
Here's the thing, Dr. McGonigal. How do you have pleasure? I would never want to lose pleasure in my life, let's say attached to food and drink, though wanting more and more of it. I mean, we can see that food's being engineered right now in this way. So
yes,
it's hard to stop after a few potato chips, or a piece of chocolate. So they're pretty smart out there.
This is where mindfulness comes into play. There are so many studies showing that if you ask people, particularly around food, what makes you happy, they will say one thing. Like, let's say they say, chocolate chip cookies, that's what makes me happy. And then you put them in a room and you hook them up to some physio monitoring, or you look at their brain, and you present them with this food, these chocolate chip cookies, you look what's happening in their brain and bodies, usually what happens is you see a stress response, a kind of a startle response, anxiety. And then if they actually consume it, usually the only reliable emotional payoff is guilt, that the only actual pleasure seems to be the moment right before you eat it. And then there is a huge decay of positive emotion as people are consuming it and after they've eaten it. And a number of studies have been done looking at this, with the, particularly the types of foods that people think give them the most pleasure. And then when you look at the foods that actually give people pleasure, there are things that people do not usually predict. They tend to be healthier. They tend not to be our go-to, sort of comfort junk foods. And in fact, if you have people track their emotions and their mood and their pleasure, people enjoy eating healthier foods more. They are happier afterwards and less stressed afterwards. They are happier and have more pleasure eating at home than eating out. And a big part of sort of getting free of the grip of food addiction is to start to pay attention to the fact that that promise of reward is lying to you. And that's why you don't give up pleasure, because when you actually pay attention to it, there's so much pleasure to be had in the foods that are not the foods we tend to get addicted to and lose control around.
So you're saying that willpower is a biological function and it can be controlled through mindfulness. When you say mindfulness, do you mean what I think you mean, which is to pause and consider?
I would define mindfulness as it actually kind of has three components to it, like willpower. The first is being clear about your intention. So what are you going to do with mindfulness? Well, hopefully what you're going to do with it is make choices that are consistent with your goals and your values. So we start from the same place as we start with willpower. What is it that you really care about? And then the thing that mindfulness adds is a certain quality of attention, that you really start to pay attention to the things that move you closer to your goals and values and the things that pull you away from it. If my brain has told me that buying this new jacket is going to make me happy, mindfulness is paying attention to how I feel as I'm about to make the purchase, after I made the purchase, and tomorrow when that jacket is hanging in the closet and my brain is starting to tell me, oh, you should go online and buy something new. That would make you really happy. That's mindfulness, really paying attention to how the whole process works. And then beginning to use that awareness to make choices that actually do get you closer to your goals. So it really is this kind of curiosity that mm-hmm. ends up supporting every aspect of willpower. It's what allows you to resist temptations, and it's what allows you to make choices even when discomfort or anxiety are present.
So you're watching yourself. You're watching the thoughts that go through your mind.
Yes, watching your thoughts, your feelings, sensations in your body, watching the consequences of your choices, and without judgment. This, you know, lots of people are very good at keeping track of themselves, but as soon as they notice something, they'll fly into some sort of judgment that makes it very difficult to recover your willpower. Mm. So maybe they'll buy that jacket because they thought it would make them feel happy and successful and whatever, and then they notice the next day that they still feel like whatever that anxiety was that drove them to buy the jacket or the insecurity, and then they start beating themselves up about it. Oh, I can't believe I spent more money again than I did to have. I'm such an idiot. Why do I always do this? And that sort of turning an awareness into a self-judgment is what really sends people back into old patterns. So it's important when you notice what's going on that you really have a sense of self-compassion about it and not self-judgment. Well, we all are dealing with this stuff.
Yeah, we have, our brains have the capacity for all these things you're talking about, everybody. Mm-hmm. So better sleep and better food seems to be connected to all this?
Yes. So all the things that we've talked about so far, including mindfulness and willpower and self-control, they kind of require your brain to be in its optimal state, just like your body needs to be in a well-conditioned and rested and fueled state to do physical exercise. Willpower and mindfulness, they are more challenging for your brain than giving in to all of your automatic impulses. The brain doesn't need a whole lot of energy to do that stuff. The brain needs more energy to exert self-control, to think about the future, and to do it all mindfully. And so it turns out that one of the best things you can do to strengthen your willpower is to take good care of your physical body, because that's what allows the brain to have access to energy and use its energy well. Sleep is an example. people who get maybe less than 6 hours of sleep a night, their brains tend to be functioning equivalent to people who are mildly intoxicated, which I think everyone knows is not good for your self-control. And getting a good night's sleep actually enhances all the processes we've talked about that allow you to make better choices. Being hungry is another example. If your body is low on energy, your brain is aware of that, and it becomes reluctant to use energy frivolously for things like self-control and attention and mindfulness. And so keeping your blood sugar level steady by eating, you know, relatively nutritious food on a regular basis instead of skipping meals or eating junk food that makes your blood sugar crash, that's going to make it easier to be the best version of yourself.
The Willpower Instinct, Dr. Kelly McGonigal, please stay with us. We'll take a short break and continue our conversation. Especially, we're going to look at how giving up control is sometimes the only way to gain self-control. Stay with us. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. We have as our guest Stanford University psychologist Dr. Kelly McGonigal. It's that time of year. Everybody's setting goals. She is author of this new book, The Willpower Instinct, a look at how self-control works and how to strengthen it. It is very useful that you should write a book like this and concentrate your research in this area, because willpower has come to be a dirty word. You know, there's been a backlash. People have paid a heavy price, you know, been blamed for some, you know, so-called shortcoming, and had people yell at them and say, well, if you just had more willpower. And so for you to re-engineer this word, to take it back and have us look at it in a different way is quite useful.
Yeah, and I think it's actually really important to recognize that when we talk about willpower, what we're talking about is this basic human nature to struggle between conflicting motives and needs and goals. That's what it means to be human. And to blame someone for not having enough willpower because they struggle with addiction or temptation, motivation, distraction, that really ignores the fact that this is the crux of what it means to be human. And one of the reasons that I actually started teaching the class at Stanford was because I felt like a lot of people were doing that to themselves. I mean, forget about parents telling you have no willpower, or, you know, relatives. People were saying that to themselves, and that judgment was self-directed. And I felt like people did not fully understand how universal the struggle was. Even if someone else's story or content was different, everyone feels like there's something they're not in control of. And there was so much shame around that and sort of self-doubt and pessimism. I thought, well, we need to reclaim this word so that we can have an honest conversation about the fact that everyone on the inside is dealing with some sort of conflict that seems like it's keeping them from being their best self.
Does this work if you, I mean, everybody's got different wiring. We're all originals. So if somebody's got wiring that tends to make them be weak in the impulse control area, in which can lead to persistent addictions, and, you know, if your wiring is a certain way and it presents a challenge, does the research hold up?
Yes. You know, one of the things that is most promising about the new science of all this stuff is the findings that your wiring is not built in. It's not hardwired, that even if you have genes that predispose you to addiction, or on the opposite end of the spectrum, sometimes you have genes that predispose you to withdrawal and anxiety, that these are genes that are modified by both your environment, the relationships you have with people, the life experiences you have, and the things that you choose to do to train your own mind and body. And there's this constant interaction between our genes and the choices that we make and the environment that we choose to place ourselves in. And so even if you're someone who has a very strong predisposition to struggle with a particular version of a willpower challenge, there's hope for everyone.
This makes clear why groups like Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, food groups, meeting on a regular basis and being reminded in your conscious self of why you're trying to make the choices you're making, it becomes clear why that's useful.
Yes. And in fact, it's funny, a lot of 12-step groups will say, you know, you have to give up on the idea of willpower. But I actually think they're really good models for what I mean by willpower. And part of it is by outsourcing your willpower, by surrounding yourselves with people who, first of all, understand your struggle so that you're less likely to experience the shame or isolation that drives us further toward our addictions. They provide support for when we are our most exhausted. So there are people in your life who will remember your goal for you, even when you can't remember it anymore, even when you are so driven by the need or the desire for relief. Somebody else will hold that want power for you and help you find the strength to follow it. And I include all that in my definition of willpower. It's a mistake to think that willpower is only at the individual level, that it's only inside of us. To a large degree, our ability to make good choices depends on the environment that we're in and whether our environment shares our goals.
Yeah, I want to get to that in terms of friends in just a couple minutes. When you say that giving up control is sometimes the only way to get self-control, what do you mean?
There are a couple of ways that can play out, but one of the biggest ones has to do with a scientific finding called the white bear effect, or sometimes it's called ironic rebound. And this is research showing that the more you try not to think something or feel something or even do something, the more likely you are to think, feel, or do it. It has to do with the brain's tendency to be very vigilant for the things that you prohibit, the things you say you're not allowed to do. So if you say, I'm not going to think about that thing I want to buy or the food I want to eat or that person I'm thinking of having a relationship with. I'm not going to think about it. Your brain will be so on alert for any evidence that you're thinking about it that it actually seems to produce the very thought you're trying to push away. And the same has been shown for things like traumatic memories and fears and irrational fantasies. The more you try to say, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to think it, the stronger they take hold in your mind. Same has been shown for emotions, for depression, and even for actions. Like, I'm just not going to think about smoking. Well, the more you say you're not going to think about smoking, the more obsessed you get, and the more likely you are to actually smoke. So when I say giving up control, what I mean is giving up the idea that you can control what's going on in your inner world, as opposed to focusing on controlling your choices. Because it is very, very difficult to prevent yourself from having a thought or an emotion or a craving. It is much better to focus on making choices than to try to think that you can control your mind and body.
Mm-hmm. That you can push those thoughts away is the mistake.
And the more you focus your control on the inner landscape, I'm not allowed to have this thought, I'm not allowed to feel this way, the more you're going to end up thinking and feeling that, and that often drives the behavior that we're really interested in changing.
So willpower, as you explain it in the book, is contagious.
And yes.
Yeah.
Good news.
So, it could be good news or bad news, because so is temptation. So tell me about this idea of being around people when you're trying to accomplish certain goals, being careful about this.
Yes. One of the things that is true about human brains is they are social brains. And we represent other people's goals and values in our own brains. So if we're around someone and we think they want something, our brain just automatically includes that in what we are aware of. And it ends up influencing our own goals and our own behaviors. And this is, it's a really great skill to have a social brain, because it's what allows us to bond with others, to understand what other people want, to predict what they're going to do. But having these very social brains means that we are constantly being influenced by the people around us, even if we feel very independent. We may feel that way, but actually we are all very much influenced by the people around us. And it's especially true for people we care about and respect. They are especially contagious. And if you're around someone that you don't like, you're not going to catch their goals and you're not going to catch their bad behaviors. But when you care about someone, or you see someone as someone you would like to be like, your brain literally catches their goals. It primes them for you. It can prime extra motivation. And then it will then be either easier to make a change or easier to fall into a behavior that maybe doesn't have great consequences.
So it's good to have a buddy.
Yeah. And especially because then you could think of it as being kind of collective willpower. Like maybe I have a buddy. Maybe I'm trying to get a project done. Maybe I want to start my own business. And I have a friend who also wants to start her own business. And we say, you know, every morning we are going to do a Skype call where we work on our business plans. And then one morning I don't have the willpower, but she still has it, and she carries us through the process. And there are examples like that for any change you might want to make. But if you have a buddy, you don't both have to be sort of at the peak of your game every moment of the day, and that there's a kind of collective pool of willpower and motivation that can support you through the difficult times.
There's a lot of talk these days about the prefrontal cortex. So it figures, you know, this part of the brain comes up in your work a lot and the work you study from other people. So tell me about how the prefrontal cortex is so important in this area of setting goals.
Well, the prefrontal cortex is the area of the brain right behind your forehead and behind your temples and your eyes. And this is the most evolutionarily advanced part of the human brain. It's huge in humans, not so huge in other animals. And this is where I will, I won't, and I want power live, the parts of your brain that control your actions, your attention, and your motivation. And in theory, the prefrontal cortex's job is to help control or restrain the parts of your brain that drive you towards more automatic impulses, like temptations and distractions and emotions like stress and anxiety. So your prefrontal cortex is kind of up front, kind of leading the way and trying to make sure that you do things that are consistent with your goals. And it's a part of the brain that develops slowly over time. You know, there's a reason that kids don't have a lot of self-control. This part of the brain is developing, and it develops until you're in your early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the really great pieces of news from neuroscience is that this is the easiest part of the brain to continue to train as an adult all the way into your senior year, 70s, 80s, 90s. This part of the brain is very responsive to training, and there are things you can do to make this part of the brain bigger and better connected.
What about young kids? If they don't have that capacity, it hasn't really formed yet, and you can see this happening where you say, please don't touch that, and they do it anyway. You know? And you think, but I just told you not to touch that. So if there's no capacity there, what is the training that we're trying to do with these kids?
Yeah. It's not that there's no capacity, but the limited capacity is fighting against very strong midbrain or habitual regions. Okay, so here's the difference between children and adults. What you need to do to train kids is different than what you need to do to build up the prefrontal cortex as an adult. So if you're interested in your kids' prefrontal cortices growing, two main things that seem to be important. One, physical exercise. That's good. It's kind of a mystery why. But physical exercise really enhances the development of the prefrontal cortex. That actually is true for adults also. But the big thing for kids is feeling safe. The thing that drives prefrontal cortex development in kids is the sense of being cared for by a caregiver whose care is unconditional and living in an environment where they feel physically safe, where there's not a sense of constant uncertainty, deprivation, separation from a caregiver. The kind of things that you might see in a situation where there really is a lot of conflict at home or, you know, living in poverty, those are the things that really impair prefrontal cortex development. And honestly, the brain is born to get good at this stuff. If kids feel loved, they will develop self-control. And that is so much better than trying to instill discipline through harsh and punitive parenting. And this is one of the biggest mistakes that parents make. They think if they can externalize the control, it will give the kid self-control. And that seems to do exactly the opposite.
Mm. So why did you do this? I mean, how did this happen that this became a leading area of inquiry for you?
I was working, before I taught this class, I was working as a health educator for the School of Medicine at Stanford. And I would go around to all of these different departments and groups, and I would tell them what they should do to be healthier and to manage stress and be happier. And there's a lot of stuff that you would expect, like exercising and eating right. And I just kept hearing from people. They were sick of being told what they should do. They knew what they should do. They just couldn't do it. There was a process problem, not a content problem. And I thought, well, you know what, I could just teach a class on the science of making these changes. There's some science around this. And I started to dive into the science. I thought it was going to be a one-off class, you know, a small class offered through Stanford Continuing Studies to the public. And the class immediately was, it was so popular we had to keep moving rooms to fit more people into it. And you know, people started bringing their children, they were bringing their spouses. And I just realized that there was a hunger for understanding both why things are difficult and coming up with strategies to make things a little bit easier. And it's still my favorite class to teach. I'm going to start it again, teaching it January through March, and I look forward to teaching it every time.
I bet that's true. And when you started looking at the research in a deep way, did you feel yourself changing?
Yes. Yes, I would say that I find with the science, everyone is operating from a few fundamental misconceptions, but we're not all operating from the same misconceptions. And I would say that the misconception that I was operating from is, I guess I was really one of those people who really believed that I had to work on fixing what was inside me before I could make behavioral choices that were really going to help me reach my goals. You know, for example, being afraid of flying and thinking I had to fix that fear before I could get on a plane. And that's like kind of very common psychology way to deal with it. Let's think about the fear. Let's change the way you think about flying. And then you'll be able to know. Actually, what the science of willpower says is get on a plane. Get on the plane first, and the experience of doing that will allow you to start to slowly transform the anxiety. And there were several insights like that that really allowed me to make some changes that, you know, I was struggling with. You know, I might have had the healthy eating thing down. That wasn't my willpower challenge. But the science has really helped me make the changes that were difficult.
And do you find that teaching this keeps you fresh and green about all this? Is it renewing to you in your choices and commitments because you're teaching it again and again?
It is. I mean, they always say that people teach the thing they most need to hear. And I so enjoy every year when I teach this class, you know, January for New Year's resolutions, I do it with my students. I ask my students to pick a goal. Or in the book, in the first chapter, I ask readers to pick a goal. And I do it every year with my students. And a checklist of things that I have been able to do teaching the class over the years, things I thought would be very difficult to change. I haven't picked mine for this year yet, but I know that this process works, and so I'm always eager to revisit it.
And when you get to that state that I often get in about 3 days into my commitment and, and I start to weaken, sometimes I'm aware that I am and sometimes I'm not. What's my task at that point?
Your task is to pay attention to the process of how it's happening. Actually, the first assignment I give people is not to even try to change, but to look at the process of how it is they are not making the choice that they say they want to make, to really watch how it unfolds. And I think people undervalue awareness as a source of strength and a source of willpower. So I would say, you think you're going to give up on day three? Why don't you set a goal? And I just want you to watch yourself. I want you to watch what you say to yourself. I want you to watch what gets in the way. What does it feel like that first time that you give yourself permission to move away from your goal? And report back and tell me what that process was. And then you can actually start to make choice points and say, so that's how that process works. Wait, let me try it again and see if it's the same if I make another choice. Oh, isn't that interesting? Because the process is almost always the same. And then you can say, all right, I know day three, this is what I'm going to say to myself, and this is how I'm going to feel afterwards if I do that. And when I start to tell myself that, I'm going to do this one thing different, treat it like a willpower experiment, and see if you get a different result.
Great. Wonderful to talk with you. And thank you so much for your work, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
May all your goals be realized.
Yeah, may all your resolutions stick.
Thanks very much. Dr. Kelly McGonigal, who is Stanford University psychologist, author of this new book in paperback, The Willpower Instinct, a look at how self-control works and how to strengthen it. As always, this show is about the richness of life. Find the books, people, great recipes, value wines, and cocktails we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.